Welcome to the Deadcast.
Officer Gene Romers of the Northport Village Police Department walked through the thick, dense forest of the area known as Aztekia Woods, his head on a constant swivel. Fanned out around him in the forest were other members of law enforcement, each of them bent on the task at hand. Romers paused occasionally, knocking clumps of wet soil from his feet. It had been raining the last few days and the ground was nearly saturated. I hope this isn't a wild goose chase, the officer thought, not for the first time. He'd been thinking it quite often over the last few days, ever since the phone call had come in saying that there was a body in the woods. This was his third trip to the area, with the last two having ended in failure. Like many of those who had gathered there today, he was becoming frustrated and had begun to suspect that there was nobody at all. Then a voice cut through the stillness, calling to him. One of the cadaver dogs they had brought had found something. Romer rushed to the officer. The dog was pulling at something in the ground, tearing at it with its teeth. Romer shoved the animal aside and gazed in wide-eyed horror at what the dog had been playing with. It appeared to be a human scalp. Dear God, he thought, she had been telling the truth. Hello again and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, best-selling independent author Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me today. I know the trailer was a little bit disambiguous, and I'll get to that in a moment. First, I'd like to let you know that if you'd like to follow me on Instagram or Twitter, I can be found at Author Tott. That's capital A-U-T-H-O-R, capital T-O-T-T-E-N. If you'd like to support the Deathcast, you can find me at Patreon at Ian Totten Author. You can also find me on Facebook at Ian Totten Author. There's a tab on the page that will take you directly to the Deathcast group, which is the reason I held back on naming our case today. I played a little bit of Can You Guess the Case this week on there, and I had a lot of good responses. I gave one clue, which is that the killer's name is mentioned in an obscure Dead Milkmen song from their 1988 album, Beelzebubba. The correct song is Bad Party with the line, "Get shut your mouth, get in the car, Ricky Casso wants to drive. When we get there, we'll say we love Satan, because Ricky always thinks it's funny." And that's who we're going to be covering today, the Acid King himself, Ricky Casso. If you don't know anything about this case, I'll start off by letting you know it was part of the moral satanic panic that was taking place in the 1980s. Ricky's case actually predates much of what would happen later in the decade, as it took place in 1984, and some see it as one of many crimes that kicked off the satanic panic. That being said, I invite you to get yourself your favorite beverage. I've got my coffee and cigarettes. Kick back, relax, and let's go into the crypt. The murder of Gary Lowers, which took place in Northport, New York, really began for police on the afternoon of July 1st, 1984, when they received a mysterious phone call from a woman stating that a body had been found behind Gunther's tap room. And initially, the officer who received the call thought it might have been a prank, because things like murder simply didn't happen in their small town. Yes, they had their fair share of break-ins and robberies and drugs, but more heinous crimes were pretty hard to come by. Even still, the officer knew that he had to follow through on it, even if it was just a prank phone call, because if it turned out there really was something there and somebody else found it, he could probably get in trouble. So this officer, whose name was Springsteen, called Officer Gene Romer and let him know about it and asked if he'd like to come in on his day off and help him inspect the area. Romer agreed, and the two men met over behind the tavern and searched the woods. This was a pretty brief inspection of the area since it was getting late and they didn't find anything, but they agreed to meet back up the next day and do a more thorough search. Before they had a chance to head out the next day, they got a phone call from a Catholic girls' school in Dix Hills. The head nun informed them that one of her students said she had seen a body in Northport that weekend, and she even gave a name to the body, that of Gary Lowers, as well as a specific place of the murder slash burial, which was Aztekia Woods. Romer, who had been placed in charge of the investigation, decided the first thing he needed to do was to go over to the Lower family home and see if there was any truth to the students' claims. When they got to the home, they found that Lower's mother, Yvonne, could only speak with them out on the front lawn. This was because their son, Gary, who was a known drug addict in the area, had upset his father to the point that his name was not even allowed to be mentioned within the house. Yvonne informed the officers that it wasn't uncommon for her son Gary to go missing for 2 to 3 weeks at a time and that she had not seen him in a few weeks. Romer was able to convince Yvonne to fill out a missing persons report, which allowed them formally to begin an investigation as to the whereabouts of Gary Lower. After this, Officer Romer headed to the Catholic girls' school and spoke with the student who claimed to have seen the body, a young girl by the name of Jean Wells. Now, the young girl, who was 15 at the time, her parents were waiting at the school for her, and when the police showed up to speak with her, they immediately assumed that she had done something wrong, and it took Romer a few moments to convince them that no, she hadn't done anything wrong. He had to question her in regards to a case. The officer then began questioning Wells as to when she saw the body, and from what she told the officers, it quickly became apparent that she hadn't seen it herself. She had been in Northport the previous day to go to the movies and hang out with one of her friends. Her friend had brought her boyfriend with her, a young man named Jimmy Troano, whom Jean claimed to be frightened of, as he was known around town as a tough guy who dabbled in drug dealing and burglaries. Troiano's face was also marked with a large scar, which earned him the nickname Drac, which was short for Dracula, and this too played into the image of a tough guy and further scared the young woman. After meeting up with her friend, Jean stated she asked them if they had seen her friend Ricky, whom she had not seen since leaving for boarding school. The Ricky she mentioned is, of course, Ricky Casso, who is the star of our show this week. Ricky and Jimmy were best friends. Jimmy then went on to state that Ricky had just killed someone, and it took him a moment to remember the person's name. He threw out the first name, Gary, and Jean immediately knew whom he meant, Gary Lower. Jean thought that he was joking around at first and even told him so, but Jimmy was insistent that it had actually happened. He claimed that it was a bad drug deal between Ricky and Gary, and that he, meaning Jimmy, and Ricky had decided to ambush Gary and beat him up. Along with another friend of theirs, Albert Quinones, Jimmy told Jean that they had lured Gary to Aztekia Woods under the pretense of having a party, after which Ricky had stabbed the other teen to death. Jean didn't fully believe what Jimmy was saying, and they decided to go to the movies, during which supposedly Gene thought over what Jimmy had said and began to wonder whether or not he had been telling the truth about Ricky killing Gary. After the movie ended, Gene decided to cut short her afternoon with her friend and went home. And went to a neighbor's house from where she called the Lauer home. She quickly learned from Gary's mother, Yvonne, that she had not seen her son in over 2 weeks, after which Gene hung up and called the police department. This was the phone call that Officer Springfield had received the previous afternoon in claiming to have seen a body out behind the tavern. Gene even offered to take a lie detector test, which to Officer Romer was good enough, and he believed what the girl was telling him. So much so that he attempted to get the Suffolk County Sheriff's Department to help with the investigation and locating the body, which was initially turned down. The next day, with Gene's parents' consent, he brought the young girl to the Suffolk County Police Department in Yaphack. He had Gene recount her tale to a few homicide detectives, and the detectives believed her story enough that they decided to join in on the investigation. When they got to Aztekia Woods that afternoon, it was raining, and because of this, they found nothing. As the dogs they brought with them were unable to smell anything over the heavy scent of thick greenery and wet earth. The next day was more conducive to conducting a search as the rain had let up during the evening. They set out early that morning to search the woods with the cadaver dogs and very quickly found what they were looking for when one of the dogs started pulling on the scalp that was sticking up from beneath the ground. The Suffolk County Crime Lab came out along with photographers and videographers, and it was pretty quick that the body was exhumed from the ground, as Lauer's was only lying about an inch or so beneath the surface. One thing that struck the officers beyond the amount of decay that had taken place was the fact that Lauer's head was down near his feet, and they initially suspected that he had been decapitated. Another thing they noticed was that the skull was completely denuded of flesh and covered with maggots, something that made more than one officer present on scene that day sick to their stomachs. Pretty quickly after this, Romer set out to find his suspects, namely Ricky, Jimmy, and Albert. They weren't able to find Ricky or Jimmy that day, but they did receive a tip that Albert Quinones was at their house. And this next bit in the story doesn't seem exactly legal to me. In fact, I think if it were to happen today, you would have people screaming at the top of their lungs on street corners and social media, because the cops decided to play a ruse. They brought another detective along with them and went to the Quinones house, where they dropped this officer who was in plain clothes off and had him go up to the house in the middle of the night and look through the windows to see if he could spot Quinones. Quinones's sister and her boyfriend saw the officer and gave chase. Now, this officer eventually met back up with Romer, and they headed back to the police department because a phone call had come in of a prowler at the Quinones house. Upon returning to the station, they had the officer change back into his uniform, and Romer, a detective from the Suffolk County Police Department named McCready, and this officer decided to head back over to the house. And this is where it really gets kind of funky as far as what they did. They convinced Quinones' sister, her boyfriend, and Albert, who had by this point joined them, to get into the car with them, and they drove around the neighborhood looking for this prowler. Now, the cops had gotten another car to go to the area, an unmarked police car, that held two officers who weren't in uniform inside it, and upon pointing this out to the young woman and her boyfriend, they convinced her it might be a good idea if she were to get out while they went and investigated. This left Albert in the back of their car, and the officers drove up to this unmarked police car, at which point the two officers in plain clothes jumped out of their car, grabbed Albert Quinones, and dragged him into the back seat of their car. I'm sorry, I understand they're trying to solve a murder investigation, but that's straight kidnapping right there. If you or I did this to somebody, we'd be looking at a real long prison sentence, and I kind of find it odd that this was allowed to stand in court, this kind of underhanded tactics in order to get their hands on a suspect. More so when they did not have a warrant to do so. And I can only imagine what was going through Quinones' sister's mind, as well as the mind of her boyfriend, as this other car took off and headed to the Suffolk County Police headquarters, which incidentally was almost an hour drive away from where the Quinones family lived. For his part, Quinones refused to cooperate with police, refused to answer any of their questions, and after two straight hours, they gave up and released him. It's a wonder that there wasn't a lawsuit involved in this. While Albert was being interrogated, police in Northport were still out looking for Ricky and Jimmy, and they found them on the 4th of July, passed out in a car across from a yacht club. Jimmy was in the front seat, Ricky was in the back seat. And the way that they came to be in the car on that particular day is really the story of Ricky Casso himself, which I am going to dive into at this point. I'd also like to throw out, if you don't know who Ricky Casso is, a quick Google search or visiting my Instagram page at Author Totten, you'll see pictures of him. As soon as you see him, you're going to go, oh yeah, I know who he is. There's a very famous wild-eyed photograph of Ricky Casso, his long blonde hair splayed out around his head, wearing an AC/DC shirt, almost glaring into the camera with his mouth hanging slack-jawed. He looks completely deranged or drugged out of his mind in the photograph. Richard Allen Casso Jr. was born on March 29, 1967, at Long Island's Huntington Hospital. He was the firstborn child of Richard Sr. and his wife, Lynn. Both of Ricky's parents taught at Northport High School. The Cassos had three other children. In 1969, a daughter named Lynn was born, followed by Jody in 1970 and Wendy in 1973. People who knew the Cassos said they seemed to have an almost idealistic Norman Rockwell type life, with one exception: Ricky's father, called Dick by friends, was what can only be described of as a sports nut. He came from a family of athletes, and he saw everything in life in terms of playing sports, so much so that there's a story out there that when his wife's water broke on the night Ricky was born, he forced her to wait until a football game that was on TV was over before he took her to the hospital. There are other stories recounted throughout the years of him doing similar things where sports came before all else, including school grades and spending quality time with his family. Reading about him, I think his shortened name of Dick is fitting because he comes off as exactly that. One example is a young Ricky who was on the baseball team. When he wouldn't do good in a game, his father would actually come out onto the field and berate him in front of everyone in the middle of the game while they were playing, to the point that the coach would have to come over and send him back to his seat. Things like that can have an extremely adverse effect on children. Ricky's been described as a fairly well-behaved, caring older brother. In fact, he immediately took to the youngest child, Wendy, and would spend the majority of his time at the house with her while the other two girls stuck. It was said that you wouldn't see Jody without Kelly nor Ricky without Wendy. Now, as I said, the family seemed to have a perfect life. They were even given a cabin up in upstate New York, where the family would go the day after school let out, and they would spend the entire summer up there fishing and playing outdoors. Ricky even worked a few summers at a local dairy farm, which he seemed to have enjoyed greatly. By all accounts, by the time Ricky was in the fifth or sixth grade, he had been introduced to smoking pot, and this became a daily thing for him. He would meet other boys over at a loading dock that was near their school, and they would pass a joint back and forth. While his classmates were inclined to just smoke a little pot now and again, it's been said Ricky wanted something more and quickly moved on to what they called microdots, which they thought were mescaline but was in fact LSD. And it was through this pot smoking at the loading docks that Ricky met Gary Lowry. Gary was born on April 30th, 1967. He was the third and final child of Belgian parents. It's been said by former classmates that Gary just never seemed to fit in despite the jokes he would tell and his outgoing personality. He was constantly taunted and picked on by bullies, and that by the time he reached high school, this taunting had turned to physical violence where students would gang up and beat Gary. Oftentimes, with the encouragement of teachers, remember this was a much different time, and back then, bullying wasn't looked down on as it is today. Teachers in schools would actively participate in fights by going and watching them, sometimes even placing bets on the fights. So it's pretty safe to assume that Gary's existence was fairly miserable as far as school was concerned. He, much like Ricky, soon turned to drugs, noticing the boys over by the loading docks near the school passing a joint, and he readily joined in. There's some conjecture as to whether or not Ricky and Gary were friendly at this point, while others insist that Ricky was in fact one of Gary's tormentors. In any event, the two boys were well acquainted with each other due to their drug use. As I stated earlier, Ricky was enthralled by drug use and drug culture, and he eventually began committing petty crimes in order to fuel his habits. The first known case of this is when he broke into a church and stole the Sunday collection plate. Naturally, being as young as he was at the time, Ricky was unable to keep his mouth shut and told anyone within his peer group that would listen of his deed. The following year, he decided to up the ante. Their local newspaper would report when families were going out of town and how long they would be gone, something that today would never go over. But at any rate, they used this local newspaper to scope out houses that were going to be empty, and Ricky and a group of other boys burglarized the house. They were caught and arrested. When Ricky's parents were informed of their son's arrest, there almost seems to have been this air about them of boys will be boys, as Ricky's father had been caught for burglarizing cars when he was in college. They may have been somewhat indifferent to their son's criminal activities, but they'd still decided to search his room, and what happens next almost comes across like one of those old after-school specials Dick and Lynn went up to Ricky's room, and instead of finding any stolen goods, they found a bomb. There was a local free drug counseling clinic called The Place that the Cassos dragged their son to, but he was not interested at all, and eventually he just stopped attending, while his parents continued to go helpless to curb their out-of-control son's actions. One account that I read has Ricky's counselor at The Place saying it doesn't seem he, like, wants to get off drugs, to which Ricky replied, "You're right, I like what I'm doing." Again, this sounds like it's straight out of an after-school special. They eventually took Ricky to a psychiatrist, and the family went for 5 sessions before the psychiatrist ceased seeing Ricky as he found the youth to be uncooperative and deliberately sabotaging the sessions. Various outlets have it that Ricky was thrown out of his house, where others state that he left of his own volition. But at any rate, by Christmas of 1980, Ricky was no longer living at home with his family. He was crashing in friends' houses, sleeping in public bathrooms, and any other place that he could find to crash for the night. He eventually hitchhiked his way up to the family's log cabin, and he brought a new acquaintance with him, Jimmy Troiano. Jimmy was different from Ricky in that he was a few years older, born on December 10, 1965. He was also adopted at the age of 5 by Vincent and his wife Mary. He has been described as a troubled youth. I already talked about the scar on his face, which was the result of unhooking a swing at the top of a swing set, and either jumping and getting caught by the hook at the top or falling from it. At any rate, the hook ripped his cheek open. He was a poor student in school who often got in fights with fellow students. One account that I read said that since he couldn't seem to get any positive attention, he settled for negativity instead. He was also known to let himself into neighbors' houses in order to eat whatever it was that they had that his parents did not currently possess. And this eventually led to him smoking pot with the other students in school who were seen as outcasts, as well as committing burglaries. One former classmate described Troiano as, quote, "fucking psychotic," and said that he would throw firecrackers at people. The same classmate went on to describe an incident where Jimmy grabbed him around the waist and tried to throw him down a flight of steps before being restrained by 2 other students, after which a big brawl broke out. Much like his friend Ricky, Jimmy was taken to The Place, where one of his counselors stated that Jimmy was unable to see the difference between right and wrong, which is generally a form of some kind of psychosis. Jimmy and Ricky became friends when Jimmy was in the 8th grade. Due to Jimmy's outstanding athletic ability on both the football field and the wrestling teams, both of which Ricky was on as well, Ricky's father later stated that Jimmy was a hero to his son. This hero worship didn't just extend to what he did on the field or on the wrestling mat, but also to the fact that Jimmy was one of the few other athletes that also partook in drugs. Because of their participation in sports, Ricky and Jimmy's druggy friends soon began to turn on them and would show up at games to heckle them both, with people stating that Ricky would say, "I hate this game, I hate this game." On one instance, the heckling became so intense that Ricky actually knocked out the opposing team's quarterback. Which is kind of surprising when you see pictures of Ricky, because he looks just like a tall, lanky youth, but apparently he was exceedingly strong. Both boys' athletic abilities soon began to suffer from their constant drug use. fights with the family's academic and peer pressure, and it's been stated that this is what eventually led the two youths to run away to the Paso family's log cabin in 1980. Eventually, they were both picked up by the police and returned home, after which both boys went homeless for the next 4 years. It was during this period when Ricky was homeless that Gary Lowry first discovered LSD, and by all accounts, he quickly fell in love with it. As for Ricky, we already know he had a love affair with the drug, but he had also begun selling it at some point. This earned him the nickname of the Acid King, a moniker which is still applied to his story today. Now, at some point in 1981, Ricky's family decided to allow him back into the house, with Dick's one demand being that Ricky participate in a sport which his son did not want to do, but to which he eventually relented. Unbeknownst to his family, however, Ricky's reputation in town as a drug dealer was steadily growing, while relations in the Casso family were deteriorating greatly. Ricky's sisters, Kelly and Jody, were excelling at athletics, and I read a number of accounts where the father basically dismissed Ricky as a perpetual screw-up, and he proceeded to give all of his attention to his oldest and middle daughter while ignoring his son completely. Around this time in our stories where the satanic aspect begins to come in, Cow Harbor Park sits just south of Northport itself and is actually outside of the city limits. At the time it was constructed, they had statutes in Northport that prevented them from declaring or any laws or patrolling areas that lay outside the city itself. Because of this, the area became a known hangout for drug users, as the cops could not legally go in there and do anything about what was taking place. A lot of the farmers in the area had been complaining of calves and goats going missing over the years, and a fear had crept into the community that there was some form of satanic group operating in the area. This was cemented in their minds when the fetus of a stillborn goat, partially burned, was found inside the park. Not long after this, the police received a tip stating that the goat was part of an organized satanic cult that was made up of at least a dozen local teenagers, and that they called themselves the Knights of the Black Circle, who were easily spotted by the black pentagrams painted on the back of their denim jackets. This group actually did exist, though, according to one former member, they were simply a group of outcast hippies who were about peace and love. This group, along with the stories of satanic rituals taking place around Northport, soon caught fire in the imagination of the inhabitants, and it wasn't long before people were telling their children to avoid the Knights of the Black Circle and that they were responsible for kidnapping pets and nailing them to trees, among other heinous acts. One member of the group has claimed in recent years that the formation of the Knights of the Black Circle was simply as a way to protect themselves from rival drug dealers from neighboring towns who had begun to target them, and that the satanic imagery that they adopted was a means of scaring people. A number of residents insist that the Knights were a violent group, while former members say the opposite. What we do know, however, is that Ricky Casso likely took some inspiration from this group, as he had become obsessed with Satanism in the 7th grade through a book he found in the local library. His father later stated that when he found this book, that's when the deviant side of his son's personality really took hold. by 1981, he was really espousing the benefits of Satanism and seemed to talk about it more than anything else. His enjoyment of heavy metal groups like Ozzy, Black Sabbath, Judas Priest, and Iron Maiden didn't help matters, nor did the rumors that were going around town about the Satanic Coven, something which I'm sure Ricky reveled in. While he was hanging out in the park during this point, there was another group that was there who called themselves the New Park Kids, and one account I read from a former member named Glenn, who sounds like a very jealous, bitter man, says that Ricky came in and spouted all this stuff off, and that he was an idiot and a poser, and nobody believed him or feared him, and that he was an awful guitarist who was nowhere near the caliber of anyone else that was in the park, going so far as to claim that one day he confronted Ricky and basically told him to piss off only for Ricky to laugh in his face. And maybe this did happen, and that's why he's so bitter, because from what I read, it sounds like Ricky just punked him out. And there could have been a level of fear there, as Ricky was known as a fighter. He was suspended that school year 5 times for getting in fist fights, to the point that he was eventually expelled. Now, when he was expelled, his parents were able to find a private school for him in upstate New York, but Ricky refused to go, running away from home. Somehow, he was able to get back into the house for a short period of time, but as in the past, it would not last. Ricky continued to spend the majority of his time in the park, as well as a new haunt to him, the Aztecia Woods, which sported what many people described as either an old, crumbled-down chapel or an uncompleted chapel. In any event, Ricky pretty much began living in the woods when he wasn't at his parents' home, and that living at his parents' home quickly came to an end when his father confronted him about his drug dealing. One neighbor later stated that everything that happened in Ricky's life was a direct result of the way Nick Casso treated his children. He went further and said that if Ricky missed a football practice, his dad would beat him in the front yard with a broomstick in front of the entire neighborhood. So it's no surprise that when Ricky's dad confronted him and said he didn't want him around any longer, Ricky simply took off. And this seems to have precipitated Ricky's final downward spiral. It was around this time that Ricky met an army veteran by the name of Pat Cossant, who was a heroin addict as well as very interested in the occult. He is said to have fed Ricky's interest in Satanism, as well as turning him onto harder drugs like Librium. Ricky's Satanism greatly deepened at this point. There are stories of him tormenting people around town with his views. There's even a tale of him writing a message about Satan, which he spelled S-A-T-I-N, in a sidewalk in Northport that still exists to this day. People have said that Ricky would also walk around town, supposedly speaking Latin, although others suspect that he may have been trying to teach himself to speak backwards, something that Aleister Crowley advocated. This behavior frightened some individuals in his circle, while others saw it as mostly a joke. The people in Ricky's circle saw him spiraling and were able to eventually convince him to go back to the place where he met a kind of hippie counselor who Ricky apparently took a liking to, so much so, in fact, that he eventually began going there every single day just to speak to the man. This did not, however, temper Ricky's drug use or his interest in Satanism. Sporadically during this period, he would come back to his family's home, at one point being chased out of the house by his father, who was brandishing a pair of scissors. Eventually, Ricky was let back into the home, although this time it was noted he was carrying a knife on him at all times, with which he supposedly threatened his sisters, and this led to Ricky being involuntarily committed to the Amityville Asylum in Amityville, New York, which, as I'm sure many of you are aware, is where the DeFeo murders took place, as well as the farce that was the Amityville Horror. This was in March of 1983, and while Ricky was detoxing, Gary Lauer continued his own spiral, stealing from friends and acquaintances whenever he could to fuel his own habits. At one point, stealing over $4,000 from one of his friends. It's been said that he was desperate for attention at this point, specifically because another teenager by the name of Albert Quinones had targeted him for abuse. Also during this time, Gary began spending long periods living on the streets or in the chicken coop of a 12-year-old girl he knew. And beyond the satanic aspects, you can start to see his life greatly mirroring that of Ricky Casso's.
First, this message. Authors and small business owners, are you looking for an inexpensive, effective way to promote your business and get new customers? Promoting on a podcast such as this one will introduce your product to hundreds of new potential customers on a daily basis. I can tell you from my own experience having done it, that promoting through a podcast is the best investment I ever made. My last two books, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia and The House of Silver Doors, were both promoted on the Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry podcast, and I saw immediate results, with sales nearly doubling overnight. Now, I know what you're thinking. Promoting on a podcast has to be expensive. Well, that's not true. If you contact me at authorIanTotten@gmail.com, that's AUTHORIANTOTTEN@gmail.com, I promise you I will give you the best deal on podcast advertising going today. I can tell you from trying to run ads on other shows, you can end up spending it from $5 to over $1,000 a placement. But if you contact me today at authorIanTotten@gmail.com, I'm going to give you 2 weeks for the price of one, and it's not even going to cost you a fraction of that. Now, the best part about placing an ad on a podcast is there's no shelf life to that ad, unlike a place like Facebook where you have to put an end to your ad campaign. I'm not going to go back through and re-edit the podcast to remove your ad, so it's going to be there permanently. So contact me at authorIanTotten@gmail.com and expand your business today.
Ricky's time at the mental hospital has been described as chaotic, to say the least. At one point, he hung himself and was cut down. This was chalked up as a cry for attention. He also ran away at least 5 times, and he was eventually able to convince his counselors that he was ready to give up drugs as well as Satan worship and go back to school. He was released from the hospital, remitted to his parents' care, where it seemed at first that things were going to go the way they had hoped. This was short-lived, however, as Ricky eventually decided to play a joke on his mother by smearing ketchup on his wrists and telling her he had cut himself. His mother threw Ricky out of the house at this point, and it seemed that he enjoyed being a street kid once again. Around this time, too, Gary Lowers dropped out of high school, with friends recounting that he fed his lying to parents about how it was over his bullying, but in reality, he just wanted to hang around and do drugs. Ricky and Jimmy were somehow able to rent an apartment, and this was short-lived as well. When Jimmy was popped on probation after driving down to Florida to pick up a load of drugs, Ricky kicked around for a while after that, spending time in a clubhouse behind one girl's home, before returning home just in time to join his family on one last summer vacation. While Ricky was upstate, Gary got himself into some trouble with the law by threatening two young boys with a pellet gun and claiming to be a police officer. He was eventually arrested for this and given a year of probation, and around this same time, his propensity for violence started to grow immeasurably, with people often recounting how he would seemingly snap at random and attack friends. As for Ricky, two of his friends had recently robbed a grave and stolen the hand of one of the men, as well as purportedly his skull, and this fascinated Ricky. This event seems to have fueled Ricky's dark desires and his thoughts of death. Further pushing this was the fact that Ricky became hooked on angel dust around this time, and would often go into the South Bronx to purchase large quantities to use as well as sell. Gary Lauer, who desperately wanted to fit in and be accepted, began to dabble in angel dust around this time, as well as take an interest in the occult, and it's believed that this is what really led him into Ricky Casso's sphere. They would often go to a local graveyard where Ricky would discuss desecrating the graves and stealing from them. He also began asking people where he could get a human skull, as he had it in his mind that he would go to the Amityville Horror House on one of the satanic holidays to do a ritual, but that he needed this skull in order to go. I found conflicting reports, but it does seem that there were some grave robberies reported in the area around this time. One thing is for certain, however, and that's that the events that would lead to Gary Lauer's death began in April of 1984, when Ricky Casso was at a party and passed out from his PCP use, and Gary got it into his head that it would be a good idea to rob his friend of 10 bags. He used some of the drugs later at a friend's house before giving away 4 of the bags. The next morning, however, he encountered Ricky in a parking lot, at which point he beat Gary and retrieved the remaining bags. He told Gary that he had 2 weeks to repay him or else. Shortly after this, Ricky was arrested for the grave robbings, which he readily confessed to, claiming he needed the remains for a satanic ritual. Although no evidence was found that anything had actually been taken, and Ricky was charged with violating a public health order. On Monday, April 30th, 1984, Ricky and his friend Pat, the Vietnam veteran who was into the occult, traveled to the Amityville Horror House to celebrate Walpurgis Night. Not long after this, Ricky had a short stint in a hospital due to the hallucinations he was experiencing from both his satanic beliefs and his habitual drug use. Once he was out, he stayed at home briefly before heading back out into the streets. He ran into Gary a few more times, beating him up and threatening him that he better have his money or else. With Gary eventually giving Ricky $30, which Ricky was incensed about, as Gary owed him $40, and he told Gary that the next time he saw him, he would be coming back for blood. This was eventually paid off by Gary's mother, who didn't want to see her son tormented by Ricky Castle any longer, and Ricky agreed to let the matter drop. As we're about to see, however, this was not the case. It's been reported this time that Ricky was suffering from extreme mood swings, at times being calm and gentle, at other times aggressive and violent, taking a baseball bat to various things in the park where he hung out. And a large portion of this can be attributed to his belief in Satanism as well as his drug use. He was also harboring a deep-seated resentment against Gary that very shortly was going to spill out in a rage. Ricky tried to return home one last time, only to be denied by his father. Ricky and Jimmy ended up sleeping in a station wagon that belonged to a friend of theirs from this point forward. This all brings us to the night of June 19th, 1984. There was a large party going on over in the park. Ricky Casso, his friend Albert, and Jimmy were there, as well as Gary. And by all accounts, Ricky and his friends were completely messed up on PCP and acid. Somehow, Ricky convinced Gary that everything was square between them and asked him if he wanted to come party with them out in the woods. Gary agreed, and Ricky borrowed a boombox from one of the people that was present at the party. Some people have stated that there was a brief moment of tension between Ricky and Gary, wherein Gary told Ricky he was happy they were buds again, to which Ricky replied, "Yeah, because buds steal from each other." Supposedly, Gary threw some money at Ricky, and Ricky laughed it off before giving it back to him and said, "Nah, man, don't worry about it. I'm completely over it." At this point, he lured Gary away from the park, and they went up to Aztecia Woods. Now, as the story goes, they all went to Dunkin' Donuts after this, after which they headed off to the woods, and Ricky noticed three crows, to which he said to Jimmy and Albert that Satan is with us. At some point after this, another friend of theirs by the name of Johnny saw Ricky, Albert, and Jimmy exiting the Aztecia Woods. Gary Lowers was not with them. So what happened? According to various reports, Ricky and Jimmy arrived in downtown Newport that morning wearing the same clothes they had been, although many noted Ricky was wearing a different t-shirt. No one noticed that Gary had gone missing, although many did notice that Ricky was missing the pentagram star he wore around his neck. When asked about it, Ricky said he had lost it the previous evening and seemed unconcerned about it. He was seen throwing something into the harbor, which he claimed later was a rock. Both Jimmy and Albert would later discount Ricky's mood at this point, stating that he was infuriated over having lost his necklace and that he had thrown a knife into the bay. That same morning, he began telling of a bizarre story about how he had murdered a man who had stopped to give him a ride, stabbing him repeatedly before leaving him in his car. Although those who were present discounted this story as just another made-up tale from Ricky Casso, they had no idea of knowing the true horror behind the words he was saying. Ricky's conscience was getting the better of him, however, and he confided in another young man named Rick that he had killed Gary. Rick initially didn't believe the tale, but the next day his curiosity got the better of him, and he and another young man accompanied Ricky up to Aztecia Woods. Both teens were disgusted by what they saw, as well as what they smelled. The whole woods reeked of the sickeningly sweet stench of rotting meat, and the leaves and sticks that had been placed on top of Gary's body were covered with thousands of squirming, writhing maggots. It didn't take long for the story about what Ricky had done to make its way around town. Although this does not seem to have extended to law enforcement, who had no idea that Lowers had been murdered. Lowers' mother later claimed she had received a phone call in the days after her son's disappearance in which a voice hissed at her through the telephone, "You will never see your son again because I just killed him," before hanging up. In any event, Ricky does seem to have realized the risk that Lowers' body being out in the open could cause him, especially considering the fact that a housing development was planned to be built in that area soon. So he and Jimmy went back up and dug a shallow grave and placed Lowers' body inside it. Lowers' body was so decomposed at that time, though, that his head fell off as they moved it, landing inside the grave by his feet. This was later explained to the police, who had initially been under the assumption that Lowers had been decapitated during the murder. Not long after this, Ricky and Jimmy left Northport, unaware that the police were looking for them at the time in connection with the murder. They were eventually able to get their hands on a used purple Pontiac through a mutual friend, and it was this car that they were later arrested in. We've already discussed what happened when Ricky and Jimmy were arrested, but what did Jimmy and Ricky tell the police? According to Jimmy, Albert and Ricky had carried out the actual murder, and Albert had known beforehand that they were going to kill Gary. Jimmy stated that Ricky had convinced Gary to give up one of his socks to help start the fire before pressing him to give up his jacket, at which time Gary cut the sleeves off and they were able to get a small fire going. Then, Ricky attacked Gary, with Albert joining in, holding Gary as Ricky stabbed him repeatedly and demanding that he say he loved Satan. There's conflicting stories on this. Some say that Gary instead said that he loved his mother, while other sources state that Gary initially refused, saying he loved his mother before saying he loved Satan. This didn't appease Ricky, though, who continued to stab him violently. The officers suspected that all three of them had actually been involved with the murder, as according to the Suffolk County Medical's office, Gary had been stabbed a minimum of 22 times. Now, here is the statement that Ricky Casso gave the police. Gary said that he got bad vibes, that we were going to beat him up. Gary didn't hear us talking about killing him. When Gary said that he got bad vibes, I grabbed him around the neck. Gary said he'd fight me one-on-one as long as Jimmy and Albert didn't jump in. I said okay and then bit him on the neck. We were wrestling around on the ground, and I made Gary say, "I love you, Satan." I was holding him on the ground, and Jimmy kicked him in the ribs. I bit him on the ear. I looked up at Jimmy, and Jimmy told me to cut his throat. I then took out my knife, held it in two hands, and stabbed Gary in the right side of his back. The knife went all the way in. Somehow, he got away and ran through the woods. I caught him and brought him back to where the fire was. I had dropped my knife when I chased him, and Troiano found it. Troiano gave me the knife, and I stabbed Gary in the back and front a whole bunch of times. Me and Troiano dragged Gary back into the woods. We started to cover him up with leaves, and he sat up. I bugged out and started to stab him in the face. After being asked how many times he stabbed him in the face, Ricky replied, "I didn't count him in how many times. I'm not really sure." When I finished stabbing him in the face, we both finished covering up with the leaves. I don't know what I said, but a whole bunch of satanic things just rolled out of my mouth. We heard a crow call, which is the sign of the devil. I knew Gary was dead then. Me, Albert, and Troiano then went back to the area by the fire. I knew I had lost my satanic star, and we looked for it, but couldn't find it. As we looked for the star, we saw blood spots on the ground and kicked dirt over them. We all then left. We went to Albert's house, where I took a bath. I changed my clothes and took the clothes I was wearing and threw them in someone's garbage can near Albert's house. The clothes were full of blood. After a few questions about his shoes and the knife, Ricky added, I must have stabbed Gary 40 times or more. I went back to the body 3 more times before I buried it with Jimmy. I had a shovel up there, and the 4th time I went up there, Jimmy and I buried it. We showed the body to Mark Florimonte because he didn't believe me. I also showed it to Richard Barton. Troiano told Mike Higgins about it. When asked as to why he had done it, Ricky replied, Gary had been ripping people off for money and drugs in town. Nobody liked him, and he got what he deserved. Not long after, Jimmy confessed to his part of the murder as they stood inside Aztecia Woods, where Jimmy showed them where the fire had been as well as where the murder had taken place. The police were able to get Jimmy to sign a confession later at the police station. He signed another one as well at another time, both of which he disavowed upon reaching trial. It didn't take long for the tale of the grisly murder to make national prominence, with stories appearing in both Newsday and the New York Post that played up the satanic angle as well as the grave robbing, claiming that it was all part of a satanic cult, the Knights of the Black Circle, of which Ricky Casso was the ringleader, discounting the drug debt that Ricky felt had been owed him. The stories pushed that this murder of Gary was in fact a satanic ceremony, further adding fuel to the flames of the satanic panic that was slowly beginning to grip America. Ricky, his drug-addled mind having begun to clear, realized that his life was effectively over at this point. He made it to his arraignment, and it was at this court hearing that the now famous pictures of him were taken. The early morning hours of July 7, 1984, Ricky Casso hung himself in his cell, using a bedsheet tied to the uppermost bar in his cell. A corrections officer who was late in making his rounds walked into the cell block just as Ricky climbed up as high as he could and jumped. Later, other prisoners said they heard a distinct thump come from Casso's cell, followed by silence. It would be over 5 minutes before his body was found by the corrections officer, at which point Ricky Casso was dead. He was 17 years old. As for his accomplices, Albert Quinones turned evidence against Jimmy Troiano, whom was later found not guilty of second-degree murder at a trial in April of 1985. While officially solved, no one has ever been convicted for the murder of Gary Lowers. The legacy that Ricky Casso has left behind is one that has had long-lasting implications in our culture, with many still believing that violent satanic cults are responsible for murders all across the country. Ricky Casso was eventually cremated by his parents. His father, Dick, died living in an assisted living home in 1991, where he was confined after he lost his mind due to Lyme's disease, which had gone undetected for decades. Albert Quinones lives in Manhattan, where he works at construction. Jimmy Troiano bounced back and forth between prison for bank robbery over the ensuing years, where he currently sits after attempting to rob a CVS pharmacy, his face covered in bandages and drenched with ketchup as he rode his stepson's bicycle. That's it for the Deathcast this week. I hope you enjoyed my retelling of the strange, twisted, dark story of Ricky Casso. If you did, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you find your favorite podcasts. Until next week, stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deathcast.